So, I'm here for another episode of Better Know a Burner, today with Doug Dodd, long-time friend and long-time burner. And this whole podcast actually started from a conversation that I had with his wife, Flo. We were sitting around a campfire, and people disappeared, and we had about 45 minutes, and I asked Flo, how did Flo become Flo? And she told me her life story in about 45 minutes, the 45-minute version. And I was just dumbstruck. It was just an amazing story, and it just kind of set the gears turning. And I knew that that was what was important about a burn, really kind of getting to know people. We go to burn sometimes and really just only scratch the surface. There are people we see every year and may not have a conversation beyond, you know, hello, hey, that's pretty cool, ooh, look at that. And then see you next year. And we just wanted to add a little, I wanted to add a little depth to the burning experience. And maybe the way to do that is to really just sit down and talk with people. And so it's a privilege here. Doug's been a longtime friend. We always have interesting conversations, so we'll try to do justice today.
We always talk about getting together to talk, you know, and it's like, we should actually do this. That's why I called you this week, and I was like, I could sit down and talk to Paul and have nobody else around.
No. There's no circus in the background.
These aren't my monkeys.
So, I think the first thing, let's get right into how did Doug become Doug. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about your mother. What kind of how did you get to be the delightfully unusual character that you are?
Me? I don't even see myself as unusual anymore. Because the more I dive into the Doug, the more I find that there's a lot of me in a lot of everybody else that I see. And so, you know, parents back in the day, first off, I'm adopted, so I have no genetic link to my parents. I never understood my mom. I always understood my dad. And it wasn't until my mom passed away and I realized that, you know, she was high functioning. She was on spectrum, you know. She would never dive into any kind of conversations with my dad and I, you know. And so I always took that as being, you know, as well, I didn't understand it. I just didn't get it. I remember, you know, there are points in my life of where I changed in microseconds with my mom. I remember because she was in a wheelchair from 1970 on due to a car accident.
Wow.
I was in that car accident. I remember it like it was yesterday. I remember being held in the rain by some stranger. You know, I was 3.5 or 4. I remember going through a tunnel while being in an ambulance with my mom on the gurney. I mean, I remember all of it.
Wow.
And, you know, when mom got mobile in being in the wheelchair, I used to run around that when I was in trouble, I used to run around the house. We had one step in the house and I would run her to the one step and I'd jump off it and she couldn't catch me. And, you know, this gave me a bit of, this is my autonomy.
Wow.
And it sounds cruel. It sounds mean, but it was a kid's mind, mm-hmm. you know, and the day that she was telling my brother to do something, and I said, no, Mom, he's not going to do it. He's coming with me. You know, these are the moments that, you know.
How old were you then? How old were you at that time?
I was probably 6.
Wow. Wow, that's an early age to.
6 or 7.
Do that. It's a teen, that's a typical teenager point of departure.
And I, you know, because I never understood her. I never understood why she was the way she was. And when my dad and I now talk about it, it's like, yeah, you know, we see now that we know more about what was formerly known as Asperger's, now just known as high functioning autism spectrum. I see it. So, you know, shaping my world. I mean, parents shape your world at the beginning, but they have to relinquish it at some point. I think she didn't willingly relinquish it. I think I took it over fairly early. And by the time I was a freshman in high school, you know, my time at home was to sleep. You know, I was doing stuff and I never got in trouble.
Who were the influential characters in your childhood?
Dad worked a lot. but he always made time to be at my soccer games. He always made time to be at the band performances. You know, I was the band chorus drama geek in high school. And so my influences really were the adults that were organized around that. But a lot of it was just the camaraderie of the people in my social circle, you know, which a lot of them were brilliant. A lot of them were talented. A lot of them were athletic. And I kind of ran the middle ground on all that. I don't consider myself terribly talented. I don't consider myself gifted in any nature. I'm a really good average Joe at a lot of stuff, but I'm not great at anything.
I would say better than average.
Thank you.
I've seen you in action.
Yeah.
So you're doing good. What did you do after high school?
I wanted to be an architect since the time that my grandmother used to draw houses and stuff as a kid, as a really young kid, my mom's mom. And I realized I couldn't draw figures. I couldn't draw anything freehand. So I got really good with a ruler. And I got really good with a camera. Because these were mechanical ways of being creative. So didn't work real hard in high school. But graduated fairly close to the top of my little high school. And it got me into what at the time was one of the best schools of architecture in the world, Virginia Tech. So I followed the path. You know, many, many, many people from my high school went to college at Virginia Tech. My girlfriend was going there. I joined a band there. I joined a fraternity there. I was at the Cave Club. I mean, I did all kinds of stuff, and it was a natural progression. In fact, my father often says, he goes, "You went to college and it was just like you went away for the weekend. You didn't express that you missed us. You didn't express that you missed anything about home. You went, you would come back and forth, and it was just, it just was." And looking back at it now, yeah, I kind of get it. It was just an extension of it was just the next day doing the next thing that felt right, and it kept me busy.
It sounded like you jumped off the porch at age 6, though, and you kind of crafted your own.
Yeah. I mean, I listen to other people's stories, and I'm like, holy crap, you had to raise your siblings, you had to do this, you know, you had to sleep in, you know, you had to live out of your car, you had to sleep in the park. I grew up in middle class, Northern Virginia, America, with a, you know, a zero accent mentality. I went to high school with every ethnic group you could ever imagine. It's not a popular term now, but I never did see color. I was just one with everybody else, my Asian friends, my black friends, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I popped off the like you said, jumped off the porch. But I had a childhood of a very clean, how do I put it? A clean stainless steel spoon in my mouth.
Okay. That's good. No, I understand. That's
you know?
Good. Yeah, no, that's
super,
very descriptive.
Super average. Mm-hmm. But I excelled in being in the world of averageness.
Yeah. Very cool. Let's transition into the Burning Man era. What was it that attracted you? Did you kind of, it seemed like you, in a way, you were building your own family, and was that an appeal of the Burning Man community, or what was it that initially?
Well, yeah. So we need to back Burning, the discovery of Burning Man up to me being totally unhappy with life in Florida. And I know many people that will hear this, that know me, will understand this, because I was very vocal on how much I hated Florida. I came to Florida because my ex-wife lived here. It didn't work out. I took a job in West Palm Beach. I lived in West Palm Beach for years. And after 9 years, I had a flat tire out by the airport. and we're talking 2.5 miles from my house. So for me, a cyclist at the time, to walk 2.5 miles home at dusk or call somebody to come get me, I walked home because I could not fathom bothering anybody at 7 o'clock at night to come pick me up. And at that point I realized, why am I even here?
Right, right.
Did I have friends? Yes, I had friends. But I didn't feel this place. I didn't feel South Florida. Shortly after that, I was offered a job in Colorado. I took it. I ran to the point where I changed my driver's license and my registration the day after I got there.
It's funny. We have so many, you know, connections with Colorado.
We
all definitely have a love for that area.
Yeah. So I'm getting to your question. Back in the day, this was when Yahoo chat rooms were big. Mm-hmm. So I just started pinging people in Colorado, basically. Hey, I'm a Floridian. I've been stifled in my outdoorsiness because there's no mountains, there's no stream, there's no snow, there's no rocks, there's no ice. You know, looking for other people that might want to go out and go play and show the new guy the ropes. And one of the guys by the name of Steve Holmberg spoke up. And so I went out to Colorado, moved out there. Flo stayed at home in order to finish up the renovations on the house so we could sell it. So I was out there for a while, and I called Steve up one day, and I said, hey, I'm in Colorado. I'd like to meet you, finally. And he says, all right, well, why don't you come out this weekend? We'll go snowboard. We'll go do something. And he goes, I'm going to be busy until like 2 a.m. because I'm working at a place, and he goes, but come by the house, let yourself in, and crash on the sofa if you need to. We'll get you set up when I get there. And I'm like, what? I'm a guy off the internet, and you're inviting me into your house without ever. But this is Colorado,
right? Uncommon here, common there.
Yeah. So we did some outdoorsy things. One of the things was we went to Salida for the, I think it was 75th. Kayaking festival that they have there, and I took my kayak with me, and he goes, all right, let's go put our boats in the water. I said, okay. I'm not going to tell the whole story because we don't have enough memory on the machine, but it ended up that I swam in 45 degree water and ended up getting caught in a keeper where I hit the bottom, and the last thing I could think of was, oh fuck, my kids. And the next thing I know, he's pulling me out. He's got the tip of his boat underneath my chin, pushing me to the shore. And I'm like, oh, I just shook hands with Elvis. I was lucky to get out of that one.
Close call.
Yeah, it was a class 4 rapids, nothing I had ever done before. Should not have been there. He and I had been going to see live music around the state of Florida, of Colorado. And he said, you know, you need to go to this festival. It's happening next 2 weekends. Go get yourself a ticket, and I'll meet you there. Okay.
What year was this?
2005.
Okay.
Threw my tent, my camping gear into my car, which at that time was a all-black Mitsubishi Diamante with black-tinted windows, you know, mob car. And I pull up to this motley crew of clown face / tutu wearing individuals at this place called the Happy Ass Ranch. And it was dusty, so I only rolled my window down a little bit. And they asked me if I was here for the country or the Western. They could tell I was new. And that was my introduction to Burning Man, because literally I had been in a 2 week funk of almost dying, not knowing how to handle it. We'll probably talk about psychedelics later, where I'll tell you the story of the rest of the story.
Good. Yeah, we're going to touch on that.
Yeah. But that was my introduction to Burning Man. That's why I went to Burning Man, because Steve said, you need to go here.
You need to go to Burning Man.
Yeah. So I went to the regional in Colorado. Apogea.
Okay. Oh, cool. Yeah. That's a nice little taste.
Yeah. Well, at that time, it was only 250 people.
Yeah.
It, second year at Happy Ass Ranch, they had just closed down Geodesica. You know, it was tiny. And, but I still have friends from that day, from that weekend.
And how did that influence your life going forward, do you feel?
Well, okay, so we got to talk about psychedelics then.
Okay.
Because.
Jump ahead.
Yeah, so I have, up until that point in my life, I had never touched psychedelics because I was frankly afraid of them. And I was very vocal. I'm afraid of those things. I don't want to do them. And Steve said, do you trust me? And I said, yeah. And he goes, all right, it's Saturday morning. We're going to do some mushrooms and the eggs. So we did. And then we kind of... We did a multi-dose of MDMA in our water all afternoon long. And then as soon as it got dark, we started with half a hit acid. I think I ended up doing three that night.
Oh, wow. Busy day.
It was a heart and mind expanding day. So how did Burning Man change my life? It flipped it 180 degrees. I found compassion. I found love. I found... self-acceptance. I got rid of that feeling that I can't call somebody when I have a flat tire. I got up the next, I didn't go to bed, so I can't say I got up. I was walking around at dawn and I went down to where the effigy had burned, and there was a lone hippie girl by the name of Swan, closed-eyed, barefooted, hula-hooping around in the ashes to a beat, a boombox with some beats on it in indescript music, nondescript music. And that was the culmination of my burn, was this peaceful, creative, inward space that I started to find. And that was really the start of the path to meditation and insight and further psychedelic work and what, you know, the me now.
Yeah. It's interesting, the memory. It's funny how, you know, little things are tied to just that vision.
Oh, yeah.
And basically deconstructing that and all it meant, the symbolism of just the freedom of dancing and beauty and peacefulness and bare feet and ashes and all of it comes together.
And you can't see it in the moment. You have to experience it in the moment. Realize that this is just now, and then you know, I had, after that, you know, that was a Sunday morning. I left Sunday night Sunday afternoon from there, and I went back to work Monday. And I get a text. I get text. Back then it wasn't a text. It was a note on Yahoo. Steve pings me and says, so, how do you feel? And he goes, no, wait, before you reply, here's how you feel. And he described the aftermath of this experience psychologically that I'm going through. You know, the downs of the couple of days, the doldrums of having your serotonin dumped, the aftermath of your first major psychedelic experience. And I'm like, yeah, how did you know that? He goes, it's called decompression, man. You'll be fine. Give me a call tonight. And, that's where I started learning.
That's interesting. I always, we get into the psychedelics. I usually tell people that, you know, it may be like a dream, but a truth once seen cannot be unseen. Yeah. And that's what sticks.
Yeah.
So you may see some weird stuff and it may not stick, but you get out away from yourself, out of your head for a little bit, and you see it from a different perspective. And if you see a truth, you can't unsee it.
Right.
And it tends to stick. And that's kind of the beautiful thing about it.
I think it's also about potential.
Mm-hmm.
You may not even identify it as a truth. You may just see it. You may go, that's got potential. Really? That could actually happen? Well, why did it happen? And did it actually happen? But I'm experiencing it. So I'm experiencing it at a level that I have to validate it as being here. And I think being able to take that potential forward to either make it a truth or put it in a little box of tricks that you might have to go to later once you learn more.
Right.
So.
So that led to continued experimentation. What was what other meaningful, you know, did it bring you into meditation, or were you seeking outside of?
Well, at the same time, I was living in Carbondale, Colorado. There was a gentleman by the name of Michael Gregory who had just 5.5, 6 years prior to that, or maybe even a little bit more, he found himself in New York City with a gun stuck in his mouth, and he was about to take his life when he said, no, I'm not going to do this. And he went to Tibet, and he spent 4 or 5 years, everything from sitting in caves to walking barefoot through the forest. And he had come to Carbondale, Colorado, and I had found him. As you know, if you believe in karma, things happen when they're supposed to, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I had had multiple other teachers that had never stuck. Michael was there, and it resonated. So I dove into meditation at that point. There was experimentation with lighter psychedelics through the Burning Man reality of being in Colorado. It was a very friendly and open place to learn without being, you know, you could ask questions. You knew where your chemicals were coming from. You knew what was going on. There was a good deal of experimentation that was, it almost even felt innocent. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm verging on 40 at that point. I was 38, 39, 40 years old. You know, I wasn't a kid playing around. And I had people that knew what they were doing.
You're a big kid playing around.
Yeah. Still am. And so, you know, out there I learned who the heebie-jeebies were. Good friends were, you know, I made one of the best friends of my life, Robin. You know, she's still... If I have a guru, she's one of two. And the experimentation was not just with the chemicals, but with my mind, you know, through the really diving into the muck. It saved my marriage. It saved me. And when I made this decision to come back to Florida, it brought me to a space here where it's like, well, I need to find the Burning Man community in Florida. And if I can't find them, I'm going to make it.
Yeah. The people the people make the party.
Yeah.
And the hills are nice. The mountains are nice.
Yeah.
But it's all about the people that you're climbing them with anyway.
Yeah. So. Yeah. You know, I came back to Florida because the house in Florida didn't sell. I didn't want to leave Colorado. There was hell no. I don't want to come back to Florida. I'd found my tribe. I'd found my space. I was in heaven living in Steamboat Springs. But we came back and, you know, started, you know, kind of learned the Fort Lauderdale and Miami crew. And back then there was a lot of energetic vampires coming and going out of the South Florida Burning Man crew. So it was very difficult to make friends. I mean, I went to two or three afterburns, two, and I couldn't get a call back after the afterburn. I couldn't give away bacon at an afterburn. Okay. And then, Sauce Boss introduced me to a crew down in Miami one night. And it was that introduction and me finally understanding why the community was so close. Because out in Colorado, it was ridiculously open, almost to a fault.
We all benefited from your connections back to Colorado, actually. We would not have as many people cross tribe between Florida and Colorado were it not for the connections you made there and then brought back and introductions that you made to us there.
Yeah. And then I just started, you know, Florence was amazing. She was not in Colorado for the first 9 months that I was out there. And then she was, and I was so afraid that And I don't know why I was afraid of this, because I shouldn't be, because she's freaking amazing. But I was so afraid of it being Doug and his wife. You know, there's Doug's wife, Flo. Well, it very, very, very quickly became there's Flo's husband, Doug.
Right.
So when we came back to Florida, you know, when Flo decided that she wanted to, you know, that we wanted to have this, you know, build a community, and then Heather jumped on board, you know, it's one thing to have, you know, some guy who's naked half the time, you know, prophesizing about something. It's kind of creepy. And then, but then all of a sudden I've got two beautiful, vivacious, outgoing, outspoken women saying the same thing. You know, people start to listen.
Right.
And that's kind of when the whole thing kind of took off. And so it's been a beautiful building, you know, those years that we built it one virgin after another at the afterburns and the preheats, and the, it was.
Yeah. I call Heather the hub. She,
yeah.
Introduced so many people. She goes and talks to everybody and then
yeah.
hunts out the unique characters and brings them back into the tribe.
Yeah.
And so that's been really a nice thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's where we met you as well. She had invited you to Kat and Al's
yeah.
place. And I think that was the first night we met.
Wow.
Long time.
A long time ago.
It's been a while. So let's see. What else are we going to talk about here? Living an authentic life. You know, that's one of the things that so many people, Burning Man community, you know, we sometimes joke that it costs a lot of money to become a socialist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to really work hard as a capitalist to make enough to spend a week out in Colorado or
yeah.
Or in the desert.
Yeah.
Or even fly around to Burns, wherever they happen to be, and have the life to be able to afford that and do that. And I know that you, like a lot of people at Burning Man, are into technology. Talk about that a little bit, or tell us about how you.
Yeah, it's funny that you.
How did you weave your life to adhere to your principles as a burner after kind of changing your life and seeing that was where the import was?
Well, it's interesting because I don't know if you and I have talked about the word authenticity. You know, I had never thought of that word until I went to a lecture at the Palm Beach Photo Center, and they were talking about individual creativity and how do you build it and how, you know, and how you need to live your own authenticity. And again, I've been to hundreds of lectures there, and this one sticks out because of that simple word, authenticity. So with the Burning Man ethos, you know, radical self-reliance and all of the 10 principles, you know, it is about being authentic, you know. And it's interesting because as I got into understanding the ethos, as I got into being part of a community, as I got into building and doing and all of the things that bring that intrigues me about this tribe that we're in called the Birder Sphere, I realized that I didn't want to hide it. Now, I do work in technology. I work in, at that point in time, I was actually working in the homes of the 1-2% percenters. And I wore my Burning Man necklace around all the time. It never came off my neck.
You had a nice one.
Yeah, I still have it. I have not lost it. That is amazing.
I've not admired it.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, I went in for a job interview one time and, you know, I said, listen, you know, I'm not a young kid trying to get a job. I said, I have two young kids and I want to spend time with them. So around holidays and this and that. And then I said, then I have a 2-week family reunion, you know, right around Labor Day. And they kind of cocked their head and they're, so you're asking for 4 weeks vacation straight off when you're just getting a job? I said, no, I'll take 2 weeks like everybody else gets to go spend with my kids, and then my grand family reunion, you know, I'll just take it without pay. It's fine. I can deal with 2 weeks no pay. And they looked at me and goes, you go to Burning Man, don't you? And I went, well, how'd you know? And they go, look at your necklace. And I went, you're
That's
right.
Funny. Yeah.
You know, I've never hidden it. There's, you know, living the authentic life means wearing it on your sleeve. Everybody's so worried about technology and, you know, I'm going to go there. Everybody's so worried about privacy. There's no privacy anymore. The reality is that if you can't be who you want to be and do it, then you might want to check what you're doing. Okay? If you...
I agree with that. I always make it a point to, because I can, and I know there are people who kind of can't. There are some people that are in job situations where they, you know, they could be fired or not promoted and things like that. So I understand their silence. So I kind of make it a point to live an authentic life, speak my mind, and say things that people normally wouldn't say.
And
just to lay the path so that other people can.
Yeah. And frankly, I do sit in a place of privilege, and I do know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm a fairly well-articulated, intelligent, white guy. You know, at the end of the day, I know that I can get away with a lot more than many people can. And I'm also, in my industry, I've got experience that employers want. So at the end of the day, it's take Doug the way he is with earrings, goatee, you know. Facial hair and earrings were not part of one of the companies that I went to work for. And he pulled me aside the first day and said, you know, we've got a policy against it. I said, well, you hired me. So I started packing up, and he asked me, where are you going? And I said, well, you obviously don't need me, because if an earring and facial hair are going to be a problem, then I'm not going to work here. And he was like, oh, all right, we'll call you executive level then, and we'll rewrite the handbook.
Oh.
You know,
even more privilege.
Yeah, I am privileged, and I know this. Okay.
Everybody stacked a little privilege on top of privilege. It's like,
but okay, at the same time,
everybody else.
But at the same time, you know, there's got to be a shift in the world that we live in, mm-hmm. so that
you have to blaze the trail.
Yeah,
responsibility.
If you can't be authentic, what are you going to be? And if people don't, you know, obviously authentic and being cruel, inhumane, or otherwise not a good person. And obviously that can even be debated, but there's judgment should not be, yeah. I mean, that's a rabbit hole we could go down for hours.
I was just, you know, I was just about to say, it's like, I know what we're going to talk about next time we get together.
Yeah.
It'll be our conversation, because I'm afraid that if we do get into all of that, we'll wind up talking.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
For 3 hours here just on that. And
yeah.
Perhaps bore everybody.
But
it could be interesting, I think.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your current projects, because you've got a number of interesting things going on. What's going on in Doug world?
I don't want to call it a farm, because I don't want to be a farmer.
You could be a PHARMER.
There you go. I have got a newfound respect for people that do farming that have, you know, daily responsibilities that you just can't shirk. I don't want to call it nursery, because at the end of the day, it's a hobby. You know, buying this piece of property up in Tallahassee, finding a heart space where I'm really at peace, then, you know, Florence and I have moved into the house. And on the property, we don't feel that we're owners. We really feel that we're caretakers until we leave. Mm. And we kind of said that even before we stepped on the property. And what a difference. What a difference not being a commander of a space. So the project is, you know, exotic fruit, tropical fruit, building a fruit forest. Hoping to buy the next door neighbor's 3-acre property, which is completely clear, put a greenhouse on it, you know, and this is...
So basically you're a farmer.
No, I'm not a farmer. You know, there's part of this that I've been working real hard all my life to make my life, my family's life, and anybody in the immediate sphere as wonderful as possible. It's time for me to give back. So, you know, why would I choose to plant 14 citrus trees? I'm not going to eat 14 citrus trees worth of citrus every year. This is a big project of, one, knowing where our food comes from and being able to partake in some really interesting oddball food. Number two, potentially creating a income source so that as I do get older, you know, I can stand at the farmer's market and not be a farmer and sell, you know, whatever I've got. And number three is to be able to give back. There's every city has a food desert, and Tallahassee's no exception. You know, there are people that either aren't aware or don't have access to anything but dollar store food.
Yeah.
And that's really crappy ass food.
Are you up on that whole subject? And, you know, I've listened to a few podcasts that discuss that problem in general.
Yeah. And how they take over towns and spaces. Yeah. I'm somewhat up on it. I'm having a tendency to isolate my own mind from a lot of the negativity out there, because then it drives me into a space where I don't want to be. I need to stay aware, but I can't stay inundated. So, you know, the I'm getting a lot of support. I've had people basically say, "Hey, how can I come out and volunteer time?" I've had a couple of people say, "Before you go looking for money, come talk to me." You know, if I can get this thing rolling, then I think I can do something really, really good with it.
You know, so. The state does make farm loans to farmers.
Yeah, but loans you have to pay back, and I'm not going to call myself a farm. Damn it. Yeah.
You obviously enjoy it because you're certainly taking on a lot of it. How much time out of your day does it take? Can you still do your regular day job?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I get up. You know, when you're in the military, your wake-up time is not of your own volition. It is when they say you should get up. So,
Were you in the military?
Yep.
Let's talk about that for a moment.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I was a snake handler too. We can talk about that later.
Tell me about your military experience, because I'm fascinated. I mean, I was in the Navy, and so it's fascinating.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about it a little bit.
So I'm in architecture school. I get really good with the camera. I joined the Virginia Tech Caving Club, for which I learned how to do vertical work. And I was doing whitewater rescue, mountain rescue, cave extrication. I get flown up and down the East Coast to do body retrievals and a bunch of other stuff. And I was like, you know what? I could make this my life. I could be a photographer, an expedition photographer. I could be the technical guy. And I was getting into all of the wilderness EMT, and I had all kinds of credentials at a lower level, not up to paramedic, but on the lower level. And I was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I cared. It felt good.
Yeah.
It felt natural for me to be doing this stuff. And so I was like, well, I didn't go to West Point like my dad wanted me to. I'm going to enlist after I get out of college. And I'm going to drive my career in the path that I want it. Well, you know, my godfather and my brother's godfather are both retired 2-stars. My dad's got connections. So I enlisted. And I decided to take that time frame and go be in the reserves. So I enlisted after college, went in. I wanted to be a medic. I got to be a medic. I decided that I wanted to be with the special forces. I got chastised for calling them because they said, "We call you." Okay, fine. So I was a non-tabbed individual with the special forces reserve group for 3 years, training hard to get to go to special forces assessment selection. And I ended up not making it once I did try, which is probably the best thing. But after 3 years of the reserves during Reagan time frame, you know, getting an architecture job, they were going to pay me $15,000 a year as an intern, and I'm like, no, I'll go bartend for double that.
Right.
So my...
What did you think about military life in general?
Well, I had it a little differently. I went in as a reservist with the elitist, that's a bad word to use, the most elite crew you could ever imagine. My command sergeant major was a four-term Vietnam veteran who spoke seven languages and was a professor at William & Mary. I mean, I didn't go in with the regular crew, right? So when I enlisted... I went into when I went from reserve to full time, I went in as a communications guy, and I asked to go to Korea, because if I go to a hardship tour, I can drive the rest of it.
Right.
Well, with my scores, my college degree, all of the things that I've mentioned, I was basically driving towards being a PA and then going in and being a special forces medic.
Wow. That's interesting.
The military is not taking care of their own anymore. You know, when you've got families that are on WIC, and you've got
that is kind of pretty strange. I joined right out of high school, and after I was starving, basically, like a lot of kids, I didn't have any place to go and wasn't making enough money to survive, and I went up in the submarine service. So I spent half my year underwater on a ballistic missile submarine, and was eventually discharged as a conscientious objector. That's a whole other story.
Yeah.
But military life in general, you know, I used to laugh. I was like, you know, I told people I actually enjoy communism. You know, we all wear the same uniform. We get up every morning. We eat, and there's food and medical care. Yep. And, you know, I'd lived without it for a little while, and, so I appreciated it more, and I was kind of curious. You know, what do you think about military life in general? And I mean, did you take to that aspect of it at all?
They sent me to Italy.
All right, like you're taking pictures of things and going
I just
tourist destinations that most people would want to go to.
Yeah, I graduated with a degree in architecture. Being a photographer and loving beautiful people, and they send me to Italy? That's not good retention. So my world of being in the military is completely different, because I jumped in as an NCO. You know, I was a corporal straight off. And so therefore I was in charge straight off. And when I went to Italy, you know, the third week there, I found myself at in a barn in the Italian, you know, suburbs at a party. And I met the people that I still talk to today, you know, out there in the, on the quote economy, which is what they call it when you're not on base. And I became an Italian local until I left 3 years later.
Wow.
So how do I feel about my time in the military? It was freaking awesome. But that's not how the military is.
Yeah.
No,
everyone has different, so many people have different experience.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although I did get to party with some people at William & Mary. I used to hang out with a bunch of poli sci students from the university and follow punk rock, new wave bands around. That's cool. That's interesting. I'm glad we got that on there. I would not have even known that. What other secrets, does the world not know about Doug Dodd that we should?
Secrets. Everybody's intrigued when I tell them I was a snake handler. I started at a pet shop. I got bored, so I went to pick up pets for the pet shop, and one of the stops was a bird aviary and a reptile distributorship. And I liked the reptiles, so I asked him if I could work there, so I quit my job and went to work there. And then that guy introduced me to a gentleman by the name of Larry Rauch. And Larry Rauch was one of the guys that introduced the original albino Burmese pythons into this world, into the economy. He was amazing. He taught me an amazing amount of animal husbandry in general. But then I got involved with doing venom extraction and, you know, messed with cobras and rattlesnakes and all the nasties, until I left for Italy with the military. So I did it from the time I was 15 till the time I was 23 or so.
Wow. Okay.
Long time. And it was amazing. You know, I have don't get me wrong, I see a black snake in the grass, it startles me. All right. But, you know, just last week I caught a 3 foot, 2.5, 3 foot water moccasin in my backyard. You know,
you just, a few minutes ago, Doug just showed me a baby iguana.
Yeah. You know, those guys are okay.
It's in your car.
It's the nasty ones that, you know, get your blood. I mean, the adrenaline that surges through you when you actually mess with something that could kill you very, very easily. I never got bit. I was very conscientious about that. I've been to rattlesnake roundups. I've had little taipans. And, I look back at it now and go, really? I did that? But at the end of the day, I'm glad I did that. I will not go back to doing that. Florence has sworn me off, you know, pets in general, other than our dogs and cats. But
they're a lot of work.
Yeah.
What do you feel about the mind of, I mean, reptiles tend to be, or perceived as very primitive. Do they have personality? Did you detect any?
There are some.
What attracted you to reptiles?
Maybe again, it's kind of like the photography and the ruler was my way of being creative. Reptiles just love me, you know, because, you know, at the end of the day, I think there's some tortoises that probably have recognition. I think there might be some of the larger lizards that do, but I, you know, most of them are, I would imagine, are fairly inert to the human experience and their experience with us. I'm 180 degrees on the pet trade that I was then. You know, I think that, and with the proliferation here in South Florida of the pythons and the monitors and the iguanas, it's a tremendous amount of irresponsibility. You know, it's,
oh, yeah.
I think the pet trade in general should be banned.
I probably agree.
Straight up.
And what's a shame is I agree with you where the turtles are concerned. I mean, I think lizards and things like that probably don't really have much of a thought in their head, but the turtles seem to actually have some level of cognition and.
Well, I think when you get up into the bigger one, the tortoises,
Those are the ones that are most problematic because they live so long. Some people don't even live long enough to take care of them or to commit.
Well,
to
it's
that
like
time.
Buying a big bird, you know, 60, 80 years for some of these big macaws.
Wow.
You know, tortoises, 120, 140 years. What are you going to do with it? You know, and then once you buy a Savannah monitor and realize that, oh, that sucker can take fingers off at one point, or a Nile monitor that can, you know, use its tail and break your, you know, fibula, you know, you don't need these things.
We always, at parties, usually we get in these conversations and people walk up, you know, as they do while you're in the middle of the conversation. And we'll be in a conversation about, you'll be talking about monitor lizards or something like that. And they'll just listen for a few moments and shake their head and walk away like, oh my God, what are they talking about? I think one of our previous conversations was transcranial magnetic stimulation. And one of the other ones, let's talk about philosophical nudism. That's a good way to maybe wrap this up with something interesting.
Well, let's go back to the word authenticity. You know, it started when I was out in Colorado after my, you know, run-in with the river and after finding the Burning Man community and feeling the acceptance and starting with the psychedelics, there was part of me that was like, we're missing something, you know? And, you know, everybody talked the buzzwords about, we don't know where our food comes from anymore. Well, yeah, that's just part of it. For me, you know, taking my shoes off, you know, that was 2005. It's now 2021, and people are just, I don't want to say they're just now talking about it, but, you know, grounding about, you know, walking around in bare feet in the dirt. You know, people are finally talking about it. Well,
you were one of the first people that I ever met that was actually running in, running barefoot, and then also in those Vibram,
the five fingers, yeah.
Shoes.
For me, it started with naked hiking. You know, I would go on a Friday night. I would pack my bag on a Thursday night, go to work Friday morning, Friday night, drive up into the mountains, and I would literally hike naked, you know, boots, backpack, and a hat, you know, under the moonlight all Friday night, find myself a camping spot, stay there all weekend, and come back Sunday night and go back to work on Monday. And I would just stay naked in nature. And for me, it's not about being an exhibitionist. It's about removing all of the clutter, getting as absolutely freaking close to being human as possible, not just physically, but psychologically. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think the philosophical nudism comes in, is because once I started feeling what that was like, the comfortableness of it, I got comfortable in my body. I'm not a well-built, muscular, in-shape kind of guy. I'm kind of a
Mother Nature
lanky.
Has blessed you. That was,
yeah.
I think I poked fun at you a couple of times. It's like it's always the guy who's hung like an NBA player that wants to be the nudist.
Yeah.
And but no, there's that was one of the things that Lisa and I would go to Nude Beach in Jamaica.
Right.
We probably did that like a decade every year.
Yeah.
And you know, you initially go and you're self-conscious about the body, but you quickly realize, you know, there's just people all over. And,
yeah.
And initially, the freedom aspect that you mentioned is so important, but then it gets into not just the freedom, but realizing that you don't have to worry about your body. I was a guy who wore a suit every day at that time.
Yeah.
And just the contrast between going to work every day in a suit and tie, and then to lay on a beach with wind blowing on you and waves and water, just such a contrast.
I mean, to me, it really was how close to being fully human can I just be? And for me, it was going and doing those naked hikes. Now, that's turned into every road trip, I'll find a place that I can go naked hiking. You know, we chose the space in Tallahassee for its privacy. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we are who we are. This meat sack we live in is a rental for a period of time. It doesn't matter if you're 18 and buff or if you're 60 and saggy. You know, it just is. And as long as we can be, just be, I mean, it's so hard in today's society to just be. You know?
True.
So.
Well, it was always good because you were the first one. So I joke that I'm not usually the first guy to jump naked in the pool, but after about three drinks, I will not let you sit in there by yourself. So I usually drop trow and jump in.
Yeah. Well, it's like at the Burning Man events. It's like, all right, we pull in on a Friday night. Oh, it's funny because my son pulls in with his girlfriend at one point, who is now going to be his wife. And Kyle's looking for me at one of the afterburns or preheats at Maddox, and he spots me in the distance, and he sighs a big sigh of relief. And Michelle goes, "Why did you just sigh that big sigh of relief?" He goes, "Dad's got pants on."
Yeah,
so
I haven't cracked that. I don't think my daughter wants to see us naked.
Yeah. I didn't give my kids a choice. It's like, this is me authentically.
But you have, your kids are great. And
and
you want to talk about fatherhood a little bit, because that
I wasn't a good one.
I don't know if anyone thinks that they are. We kids wind up being fairly resilient. We're all kind of raised by wolves.
Yeah.
And by virtue of the age that people have children, they're not ready to raise children.
Well, I had my kids in Italy. Kyle and Ian were both born at in Pisa. My former wife came back to the States shortly after Ian was born. I came back, and we lived right next door to her parents, for better or for worse. And 2 years later, I left the family. And I had a tremendous amount of guilt, but I knew it was the only way that my kids were going to see the right side, the correct side of my former wife and the correct side of me is separately.
Right.
Have I worked through all that guilt? It probably already sounds like I haven't, because I haven't. Shortly after I left, I went to West Palm Beach and I met Flo, and I always tell her the reason I am the father as good as I am is it's her fault. And I say it like that jokingly, but what I really mean is that she pushed me to be a better dad. I can't say that I was absent, but I wasn't there enough. And that, to this day, you know, with my kids being close to 30 now, to this day, it bothers me still. But I do see Florence and I do see Flo and I in them. And
oh, yeah.
They remind us of us now. So bits and pieces were good. You know, I think, you know, Ian has migrated out west to, you know, and he's with mom, you know, his mom, and Kyle's migrated back east. And
I've had mostly conversations with Kyle, and
yeah.
And he's brags on you.
Oh.
and generally nothing but favorable things to say.
I pay him a lot.
Glad that you're wearing pants.
Yes. Yeah. When you bring your girlfriend to her first burn.
To meet your dad.
Yeah.
What better way to explain let me explain my dad. No need to explain. There he is over there with no pants.
Yeah.
That's my dad.
Yeah. You know, and I've had people outside of the burns, you know, when I go to functions down in Fort Lauderdale, you know, they ask me about the nudism. They ask me about why. They ask me about how, you know, they ask me about my kids and what they think. And you know, it's like serving your kids alcohol. You know, when I lived in Europe, kids drank wine sparingly, but you were educated. You know, I wanted to educate my kids on the things that need educating. I don't want to keep anything taboo. And if it is taboo, then I want to tell them it's taboo.
Right. First nude beach that I ever went to was in France. And, so I asked somebody about that, said, you know, just kind of curious, and they laughed. They just like silly Americans.
Yeah.
Why would you wear clothes in the water?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
you're getting clothes wet.
And they get all itchy when you get out.
Yeah.
It's stupid.
Yeah.
And you know, they were right.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm not out there trying to shock anybody. You know, my goal is not to show off. I do it for me. And where it's not appreciated, well, then I don't do it.
Well, I knew you were an interesting character the first time I saw you cooking bacon with your clothes on. I knew there's a guy who's braver than anyone else.
So many people talk about that thing. I mean, it's, yeah. And I actually, Bruce took some photographs. And so I actually have some, you know, G-rated photographs of that where, you know, there's a pan in the way and there's the R-rated version of it. But I'm glad I have it documented. I think,
you know, that was another thing that I wanted to compliment you on. You, between you and Bruce, you, now I can say our youth because it's been so long. It's like you, between you and him, you documented our youth in ways, taking pictures of, times and events that we don't even remember in some cases, or would not otherwise. We're not for all of those great pictures, always making us look fantastic. And,
well, of course.
And it's I really treasure the photos that you've taken throughout the past.
Thank you. I lived with that camera for many, many, many burns, and you know, there's. I always tried to find a happy medium between being in front of the lens and not, or being behind the lens and not. And, you know, I needed to experience enough of it to know that I experienced it. But creating some of those photographs was part of that Burning Man experience that I, you know, cherish.
I certainly do, and I think most other people that were fortunate enough to have you click them do as well.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you want to add in? Any wit and wisdom, or wisdom for the younger generation that's carrying on the traditions of the burn?
Oh, you know, everybody says the burn has lost its magic. The burn's this, the burn's that. It was better last year. It'll suck next year. You know, I still, from my perspective, I think the burn's doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing. If you're excited by the burn, you're supposed to be excited by the burn. If you're perturbed with it, fine, be perturbed with it. If you don't think it's good enough, go do something, make it better. You know, it's a duocracy. Do it when you see it. So in my opinion, you know, I don't know what the longevity of the party, that thing in the desert, is going to be, just because of all the politics that have to be played, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that we should continue with extreme vigor in the decentralization and regionalization of the efforts that we're doing, because it's important for people to have community and tribe. And I think it's still doing. I think the overall ethos is still doing what it's supposed to be doing. It may not be one big party in the desert a year, but it might be a dozen little ones in your local or regional area. And that's okay.
Yeah, I agree. I think the beauty is in the effort and in the hardship. The hardship brings people together. It forces them to work together and come together in ways that they wouldn't otherwise if it was just a luxury cruise. So I revel in its imperfections.
Oh, yeah.
And the lovely imperfections of all of our cast of characters and tribes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I don't, you know, I'm at a point now where 2005, so that's quite a few years. I'm planning to remain active. You know, Florence and I have diminished our participation across the country, but we're still, you know, regionally, we like to do it. And we may actually, now that COVID is starting to loosen up, we may actually start to do some gatherings at the house and, you know, start to build another region.
Lisa, you were telling us about that this evening, and Lisa christened it Doug Burn.
Yeah.
Tell us about Doug Burn for just a moment.
Call it Doug Burn because it is the Doug and Flo show.
Okay, yeah. So.
Think WandaVision, right? Doug and Flo show.
Okay.
yeah, they stole that idea from us. Yeah, I mean, we're on 3 acres. We're hoping to get 3 more acres. And, you know, there have been fairly consistent smaller gatherings around the country that people go to, whether it's Soup Stock or, you know, wherever it may be, up at Big Daddy Doug's. And, you know, we found this property. We fell in love with this property. And big part of this property was to be community. You know, unfortunately, we got in. We started doing the small amount of renovations and up, you know, and then all of a sudden COVID hit. So, no, we're not having any parties right now. But coming up, I think, you know, we need to find a weekend that doesn't coincide with the crawfish boil in Tampa and, you know, all the other, you know, kind of mini gatherings that we have. And maybe we can have a 60 or 80 person gathering there at the house of,
yeah, I love that.
You know, friends and family.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I'm missing friends and family. I am really, really missing.
Yeah, it's been a rough
the crew.
Year and a half so far. So we're still, yeah, everyone's still trying to recover and get back into the groove.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Thank you for letting us better know a burner.
Yeah, I like
and,
it.
And
glad I could participate.
That concludes another episode of Better Know a Burner. Thank you, Doug Dodd.